Hello, reader. You're plugged in to another episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. We hope you enjoy it.
Well, welcome to today's episode of PageCast. I'm Anthony Molyneux. I'm a journalist for the past 11 years, and I've also directed a number of documentaries. But most importantly, today I get to speak to Nicole Engelbrecht, who is a true crime podcast producer, definitely the biggest in South Africa, with tons of listeners. But she's also an author, and she's written some incredible books on probably some of the biggest cases of South Africa, one being Sizzlers, another being Samurai Sword Killer, and now most recently Bare Bones. And I get the privilege to read it and speak about it afterwards with Nicole. Thank you so much for being here. How are you today?
I'm doing very well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you. Thank you so much for reading the book and doing this chat with us. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I mean, at first when I read the book, I was actually amazed at how easy it is to read. I just got page to page to page. It was really just, you wrote so eloquently and so well that it just felt so natural to just carry on and carry on and carry on. And I mean, what was the reason behind doing this book? Because obviously you do a lot of true crime things, mainly in the podcast studio, but obviously you stepped into the realm of author with this one. Mm. So what is the reasons behind this book?
Sure. So I think my other books have been single case books. And when I looked to see what I was going to be doing on my next book, it was a sort of a discussion between myself and Jill Moody of Jonathan Ball Publishers. And we thought about sort of theming a book around 10 different cases in, you know, I gave them a few different ideas, and Unsolved was one of the ideas. And I honestly didn't think they'd pick it, but I was pleasantly surprised when it was the most popular choice among the Jonathan Ball staff. So we went with it, and I think that really it's a culmination of 6 years of work, of course, on the podcast, and really important to bring these cases out into a different public, because my listening public and my reading public don't always intermingle. So get new eyes on these cases and get more people talking about it. And then we also, certainly I wanted to use it as a form of education for the public.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things, is it wasn't just chapters around cold cases. You also dove into certain things around police, and most importantly, what victims can do to actually go to the police, what is expected of the police, so that they're more informed in when they have to deal with these sort of situations. I imagine that you've had many occurrences where people say they just didn't know what the police should have done and they felt let down by them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's, you know, glaring examples in the book of cases that may have been either much further along or solved by now if really the families behind had been empowered with some of the knowledge that's in the book. And we see it every single day. You know, I see a lot of members of the public that just simply don't know what to do, because it's not something we really want to think about, right? We don't want to have to empower ourselves with this knowledge. But I think as South Africans, with our crime rate being so high as well, it can make us feel sort of very disenfranchised and powerless. So one of my hopes with this book is to make not just, you know, future, sadly, victims and their families empowered with that knowledge, but just everyone, so they can feel like they are moving through the world, in less of a looking out to see what's going to happen to them next mindset, and more knowing what they can do if they need to.
Mm. Yeah, I found that really interesting. And it's so important, because we don't really know, unless you're work in the crime sort of space or preventing crime space, normal people don't really know what police should do, shouldn't do. You don't know what the judicial system does. So it was so, so interesting and refreshing to actually get that knowledge, because there were some things that even I didn't know, generally about the missing persons. If you go and report them within 24 hours, normally there was this big rumor that you could only really register the case after 48 hours or something. Yeah. But we know that that's not true. So there's a lot of those nuggets in this that is so important for the public. I mean, one of the missing persons cases, Desiree Reed, was obviously you opened with that. And I found that knowledge, or sorry, that quote of the flapping notes on the front door left by her mother. I mean, it's absolutely heartbreaking because she's basically so afraid that her daughter may come back and she's not going to be there that she's left that note there for her. I mean, this obviously was also a seminal case for you. I mean, you opened with it. Can you explain why it was such a seminal case for you?
I think it's, you know, Desiree's case became one of the first where I had direct contact with the family, where I really got deep down into what the family's experience had been with such a long unsolved missing person case. I think you were going up to 20, 24, 25 years now. And I also started to see a lot of sort of reflection of my own life in Desiree's life and her family's life. And I think that was part of, perhaps selfishly, but part of what sort of drew me to her case and has kept me going. And I've just been so lucky with Desiree's family that we've formed this relationship, and I honestly count them among my friends now, you know, and especially Desiree's niece and nephew, it's been incredible to be able to be supportive toward them. You know, her niece in particular, Alyssa, wants to go on now to work in this field. She wants to be a forensic pathologist because she wants to be able to help people. You know, the sad truth is that Desiree may have been in a mortuary somewhere over the years and has been buried as by the state. Without the family knowing. And Alyssa now wants to go into forensic pathology to help future victims. And just this morning, before I came to this interview, I got a message from Alyssa's mom, Janet, telling me that Alyssa's going off this morning to Johannesburg Mortuary to job shadow. You know, and we had a bit of a funny moment where we laughed about how dark we were being for being excited for her to go to a mortuary, you know, but it's understandable in the circumstances. So certainly Desiree's case has been definitely a seminal part of the True Crime South Africa journey.
Yeah, and I mean, the fact that, I mean, I didn't know that the song Void by Fragmented, which is obviously Desiree's nieces, I mean, that is now the theme song for your podcast. I mean, it is sort of that opening case that kind of broke the ground for you on this. And I was just wondering, I mean, based on this this case, do you think you would have continued as progressively as you did without this case? Because you saw a lot of positive things coming from it. I mean, did it give you a lot of motivation to continue, or do you think you were always just going to continue with this?
So I think it certainly set me on a slightly different path. I think if this case hadn't happened and I hadn't had the positive experience there, I may not have continued to focus on the unsolved cases as much. I may have convinced myself that it was too risky and I was just going to do more damage than good. But I think what Desiree's case taught me was I can approach this ethically, and, you know, if I do it smart in a smart way, I really can do some good here. Whether or not I would have continued on without Desiree's case, I probably would have, but it probably would have been more just down the sort of storytelling solved cases line.
Yeah, and that was the interesting part as well of the book, is you really go into how difficult it is for the people left behind and how they have to deal with these cases that just go on 1 year after the other. I mean, there's no, you can't compare, but, you know, when someone's loved one is found, or, you know, you have some form of closure for the story, then you can kind of move on. But with these families, unfortunately, you can't. And I really loved the quote that you gave. I mean, it was somewhere at page 44 where you said, "And they must somehow grieve the life they once knew while simultaneously trying to keep hope alive for their loved ones." And I really felt that was such a good way of putting it, because, you know, you're trying to keep your hope alive, but you're also grieving and you kind of don't know where the middle line is, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's this sort of ambiguous grief, where, you know, people who have sadly lost a loved one and they know that their loved one is deceased, their grief journey is perhaps not predictable, but they know that they can now embark on that grief journey. But for these families of the missing, going on that grief journey is necessary for their mental health because, you know, as I say, they must grieve something. But they don't quite know what to grieve because, you know, what am I grieving? Because this person's literally just disappeared into thin air. And I think I've come to understand how these families, they're sort of forced to choose between continuing to push for their families and their family member and telling the story over and again, while at the same time, that has a huge impact on their mental health. You know, and I've seen some really negative consequences from that where family members have just had to say, I have to leave it in, you know, whatever you believe in, the universe's hands now, because I simply cannot continue to focus on this.
Mm. And that's what makes these cases so difficult to cover, right? Yeah. Is because on the one side, you've got these people trying to deal with it and have to repeatedly tell their story, and then you might get some hope and some lead coming in, and then that leads nowhere, and then the next thing you know, they've built their hope up and once again it drops. Mm-hmm. So that's the one side of it that's really difficult. The other side is obviously on the media element, which is people generally like stories that are closed, that have an outcome, that, you know, the person was caught, they went to jail, and then the family can move on. Mm-hmm. And that also makes it harder for us as storytellers to tell these people's stories, right? Mm-hmm. So I found it really refreshing that you went this route with the cold cases. So the title of the book, Bare Bones, I thought was a really smart title. And it really comes from page 60, where you mentioned that the fact that skeletal remains are less emotional for people than recently deceased, you know, cadavers or people. It's you know, flesh, and the actual sight of that is a lot more emotional for people. Mm-hmm. But it's also still important to remember that it's a human being, even though it is bones, yeah. Bare bones. I mean, was this the driver for the title of the book?
So the title story is interesting because obviously I opened with this scene where I'm in a anthropology department in a university. Which, yes, actually did happen. It's not imagined. And I'm speaking to this professor about these boxes and boxes and drawers of bones that they have of unidentified individuals. And that was going – Bare Bones was going to be the title of the first chapter, that where I describe that scene. And I thought it sort of had this – double meaning, where it's also, you know, when you're investigating a case, you're breaking it down to the bare bones of, you know, the facts. And I guess in a way also, you know, just it's the bare bones of our humanity. It's, you know, as I describe in the book as well, everything that gets layered on top of the skeleton that carries us around is what makes us human. And then my very clever publisher, Joel Moody, spotted the title, and I mean, I was going to go with something boring like Unsolved South Africa. And she said, no, we're not making this a chapter title. This is going to be the name of the book. So kudos to Joel and, you know, the joy of collaboration. But yeah, I think it's a multi-layered title that I think is, yeah, pretty perfect.
Yeah, with this book, obviously, true crime is probably arguably at the highest popularity that it's ever been. I mean, you can go onto YouTube, you can go onto any sort of social media space. There's someone doing something about, you know, cases or covering cases, and it's across the world now. Mm. I mean, even when you look at the big streamers, crime is very, very popular amongst viewers. Mm. But one of the things you do make... You kind of repeat in the book, repeatedly say in the book, is about being empathetic. Mm. And following your gut when dealing with victims. And one of the stories that you gave was, you know, having to approach victims of crimes was always difficult for you. Mm. And can you just take us behind that process? Because, you know, balancing trying to get their story, but then also being empathetic, those two things can sometimes get very blurred, and you see that a lot in other sensationalist type things. Mm.
So I think what was beneficial for me is that I wasn't working for someone. So whether someone said to me, no, you can, no, I won't speak to you, or yes, I will. Of course, it made a difference to me because I would have wanted to tell that story, but there was no one sort of above me saying, go back and push again. So that was beneficial. And I think, you know, in the this was really more of a concern for me in the beginning because, of course, no one knew who the heck I was because I was literally, you know, no one related to, you know, I wasn't a journalist. There was nothing I could, you know, it was a packaging manager approaching. So it was kind of a weird situation. And the way that I really just tried to approach it was authentically, I had started this podcast to be victim focused. And I think that when I approached victims and their families in that way and telling them that this is not for me about sensationalism or, you know, clicks and views, it really is just about me wanting to tell the victim story and, you know, get the sort of truth out there and not focus as much as everyone else does on the perpetrators. That started to resonate with a lot of people. And then over the years, it's become far easier. People have now started to approach me because I've built up sort of a bit of a public name and families have referred each other to me. And now I'm really, I have a list of families that want me to cover their cases on the podcast.
Where do you think that comes from, that sort of innate gut feeling, like you said, of empathy when dealing with this? Do you feel like you've always had that?
So I think it's been a bit of retrospectively, I now understand that I probably did learn a lot of this in my childhood. So I had a sort of a chaotic childhood, and I think came to understand that not everyone deals with things the same way. And I think I had almost a natural sort of trauma-informed way of approaching things. But saying that, I've also learned a lot from the people that I've worked with over the years, the families that have trusted me with their stories. You know, I've learned things like not everyone is able to share their story in the same way. So some prefer writing it down, some prefer voice noting, some prefer a phone call. Those are just little things that I think have layered on top of perhaps that natural trauma-informed approach to really hopefully make it easier for these individuals.
Yeah, I mean, whenever you're dealing with these types of crimes and in this sort of space, you people always ask me as well, you know, how do you deal with that? Like, doesn't it affect you and whatever? And I always say, like, some people, you know, there's just layers that people can handle and other layers that you can't, right? And for example, with a forensic pathologist, for example, I would never be able to do that, right? Yeah. Whereas other people can do that, but wouldn't be able to do what I do. But yeah. It is interesting how our experiences growing up really does prepare us for what we're going to do one day, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So the other very interesting case, which was also extremely sad, was Connor Isaacs. Mm. And I mean, I do want to get to the cliffhanger at the end of that chapter, which we can talk about. But would you like to just give sort of a brief summary of Connor Isaacs? Because I do think it was quite a heartbreaking story too.
Sure, yeah. Connor's case is one that's stuck with me over the years because it was the first one where I met the parents face-to-face. And, you know, that face-to-face experience of grief, I think that is what a lot of true crime content creators miss. Because it's very easy to read words on a screen or on page, but when you see the human embodiments of that in front of you, it changes everything. Connor was a 15-year-old boy when he was murdered. He lived in the Western Cape and he was on school holidays. He was playing Xbox in his home. His dad was at work. Should have been safe. You know, his dad had just moved them there a week before because the area was safer than where they were living. And someone broke into the house, made entry, and murdered him. And his dad found him when he came home that evening. And, you know, that was the beginning of this sort of battle especially for Connor's mom, for justice going forward.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned at the end of the chapter, I mean, it was such a sad, sad case. I mean, just to think of this boy sitting there playing his Xbox and then someone breaks in and does that. You did mention at the end, because obviously this is a cold case book, and as much as I knew that going in, every time I read a chapter, I thought, I just kept on thinking, maybe at the end of this, we're going to hear something.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it isn't. And that's part of the book's purpose, is to try and get this out to more people so that hopefully we get that one lead that can lead to the solving of the crime. Yet in Connor's case, what was interesting was at the end, you did say, hopefully by the time this goes to print, there might be a positive lead that I can tell people about. Is there any positive lead?
So I was quite surprised by that call that I described with Bridget towards, that was sort of towards the end of putting this book together. And I'd thought that there was sort of nothing happening, and then my chat with Bridget sort of changed that. At this point, I unfortunately still can't really talk about what has happened, but suffice to say that it is further along than it's ever been since I've covered it on the podcast. And, there is a positive path ahead for resolution for his family.
Yeah, and it's so tricky because you always, and it's happened to you a few times, you mentioned in the book, where you think, wow, I've got it. This is the tip off that's going to lead somewhere.
Yeah.
But you almost get burned because you put so much hope into that lead. And then when it leads nowhere, it almost like it has to, you have to go through the whole grieving process again.
Yeah, absolutely. And, that's made me think about how the families must feel like about that.
As you said, this is around Linda, who's also unfortunately a victim. Well, also looking for their loved ones. You said in September 2020, Linda was suddenly thrust into a world she'd only ever viewed from afar, the world of missing people. Within this new universe, desperate family members exist in the orbit of police officers, private investigators, leads, scams, hopes, disappointments, and endless hours of worry. Mm. And it just really does sum up what it must feel like, because you're dealing with all these players that you've never had to have communication with, and now they're an integral part of your life. I mean, private investigators are not cheap either. So you're just basically worrying and dealing with people, and your whole world kind of changes, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's wild. I can't even imagine it. And I think I describe later in that chapter, or perhaps earlier, where it's just such a weird idea to think that someone is forced into this existence where they now have to sit down and talk to this complete stranger about the most intimate and difficult parts of their and their child's life.
Mm.
And make that decision for their child as to, am I going to share this? Because is it going to help?
Yeah.
And how are they going to feel about that when hopefully one day we find them?
Mm. Yeah, there's a lot of private stuff that you don't want to tell people about, right?
Yeah.
Obviously, the lack of documentation and due process in South Africa is also a very, very big problem that we uniquely face here compared to, let's say, for example, America or Europe.
Mm.
I mean, the one example, Keegan DePloy, was also one of the chapters in the book. And he had this sort of unusual case where he was arrested and then COVID hit. And then all of a sudden he was in jail for a very long time, but waiting for his court appearance.
Mm.
And then when eventually he did appear, allegedly, then they let him go, right?
Yeah.
And no one has ever seen him since.
Yeah.
And I mean, the one thing that I found quite frustrating about that was the Department of Correctional Services, who he was in custody of.
Yeah.
They didn't really assist much, and they didn't assist with information. And obviously the documentation was really weak. You have spoken to other podcasters around the world, and they also deal with missing persons cases in their countries. Do you think we fight a bigger battle in terms of documentation or looking for people because of our documentation issues than other countries?
I think it affects more cases, certainly, than in other countries. I do regularly hear about similar issues where I think, wow, this could have really been a South African case, because it's, all the same sorts of stuff. I actually yesterday sent Desiree Reed's sister a podcast episode I'd listened to about someone who'd been missing in Ireland for 24 years. Mm. And just his sister speaking about exactly the same issues that Desiree's family has faced.
Okay.
I just think it's less frequent. You know, if we look at murders, for instance, in the UK, their murders for a year are the same as ours for 2 weeks.
Mm.
So that gives you a difference, you know, in scale. But systemic issues, I think, are a problem everywhere. We are just, unfortunately, very badly resourced. You know, distribution of resources here in South Africa is very poor.
Yeah, I mean, it's not all doom and gloom. There is this DNA Act that was recently put forward and by Vanessa Lynch, I believe.
Correct.
I mean, this is huge for crime solving, and it could definitely open doors for missing persons, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, how important do you think this is going to be for going forward for that?
So I think specifically for missing persons, that's going to also take the victim identification centre making sure that they have DNA from all the families. So Desiree Reed, for instance, her DNA is still not in the database, has still not been taken by the victim identification centre. So that's a problem.
Is that because of a backlog, or they're just like getting through the most recent stuff and then they'll start going back in time? Or
not necessarily. So specifically with their case, it's been a matter of finding the right people to actually get someone out to them or get them to go out to the center and hand the DNA over.
Okay.
It's really just been that. And, you know, on the other side of it, when, you know, the backlog is a big issue, I do think that where this act is going to be very, very important is in cold murder cases. Mm. So where the first time that we had incarcerated offender DNA being run through the system, we had it running for, I think, it was 4 or 5 months. And every single day that was being run initially, they were getting a hit every single, at least one every 24 hours.
Wow.
Which just goes to show, you know, these we know that people generally do not just commit crime once.
Mm.
You know, so it is going to be huge, but our backlog is a huge issue.
Mm.
You know, in 2022, I think it was, Minister Chele at the time said that we were up to date. And whether or not that was true, I don't know. But today we are 150,000 cases behind.
Jeez.
Samples, I apologize, samples behind.
Mm,
So that is a huge problem. But the act itself is deeply important.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the borderline bare minimum we can do is just get the DNA database sorted, right?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I mean, how many cases will be solved just like you said because of the recidivism rate in South Africa, or the reoffending rate, whatever you want to call it, is 90%, which is just unbelievable to even think about. And maybe there's just a lot of bad apples out there. And if you actually get them off the streets, South Africa doesn't have that many criminals. It's just the bad apples repeating crime. That's where the issue is.
Yeah, absolutely.
So in one of the cases, you did mention the description of one of the missing persons. I was interested in why no photos of the missing people were given. Was that because it could throw people off because they don't look like that anymore? Or is it difficult to find those photographs? Or, you know, what do you think the problems with giving a photo now is?
Mm. Look, just from a publishing perspective, it's actually quite difficult to include photographs in books. Because of the publishing process being so different from just a text-based book. But also, yes, what you've just mentioned is very important. Many of these cases are very old, and it is very, very difficult to get a proper photographs, you know, age-advanced photographs. People think these apps that you can download can do it, and it's just, you know, speaking to Catherine Smith, who's a professional forensic artist and works in academia, she looks at some of these age progressions and she just says, you know, that's ridiculous.
Mm.
It's literally just their old face with wrinkles put on it. You know, so that certainly was a consideration as well. We don't want to send people down the wrong path.
Yeah, because then they end up just sending you stuff and it's like completely wrong. Yeah. Mm. Now, I'd say the most striking chapter for me was Lightning Strikes Twice. And I know that it's also, you get a lot of people, you know, throwing around their ideas and theories around this one. I mean, it is just about these two sisters that end up, one ends up missing and the other one ends up murdered. Could you just give us a brief background to it? And I do want to speak a little bit about the in terms of the predators that are living around us and amongst us. Is a terrifying thing to think about. But can you just maybe just give a little bit of insight into the case?
Sure. So it's Edna and Blanche Piercy, sisters who, very sadly, within 9 months of each other, Blanche was murdered and her body was found. And then just 9 months later, I believe it was, Edna completely disappeared and has never been found. And this happened in Rustenburg. And since then, you know, Blanche's murder remains unsolved. Edna, as I mentioned, has still not been found. And the horror of that happening to the same family is just firstly unthinkable, and of course resulted in many questions being asked. You know, everyone assumed, well, it's got to be someone close to the family, because how is that possible? But then, as I discuss in the book, the PI, Leon Rousseau, who does a bit of pro bono work on some of these cases, figured out just how many really disturbing predators were actually living in the area around Blanche and Edna at the time. And that just sort of adds this another horrifying layer onto this case.
Because, I mean, there's so many things, because the dad was also, you know, investigated, and a lot of people, you know, point fingers in to the closest people around them. That's generally, you know, where the police look first, and then they extend outwards. And there was this whole thing with the school bag, and she had to go and fetch it from a friend, and then she went missing. Yeah, it really was I don't want to say interesting, but it's such an unusual case, you know, for two girls to go missing from the same family within a year. And it was just a shocker. And of course, this name, Gert
van Rooyen,
came up, and who's obviously an infamous person. What was the story with him as well? Because that just added more layers to the story, right?
Yeah, so in the Piercy sister case, it was a very outlying connection where they'd actually, when they were younger, attended the same school, primary school, as some of his victims. So that was just an outlying connection. But what was fascinating to me was how every single time his name is mentioned, people go, oh, he must have been involved in, and, you know, he'd been dead for 10 years by the time Blanche and Edna, you know, their terrible circumstances. But yeah, that was fascinating. And then, of course, there was a connection to him, possible connection in the Meadowdale Doe case as well.
Yeah. And then at the end of that chapter, you said, as I end my call with Leon, who is the PI, I picture an aerial view of the neighborhood where the family lived. I picture the houses with what we now know were sexual and otherwise violent predators living in them. Their neighbors were none the wiser. And that's probably no different from most South African neighborhoods. All mowed lawns and neat fences on the outside and dark secrets within. Mm-hmm. And that was also quite scary, because we know that the sex offender database in America and in other first world countries are well documented, and you can go on and look anywhere. And you'll see if they're living there. But we don't have that, right?
No, and I think that was allegedly going to be happening earlier this year. And then I think they realized, oh, we may have spoken too soon, because, you know, other legislation that we have goes up against that. But I do think that would be important to be released in a controlled manner.
Two more questions from my side. I mean, you did mention a few times in the book that you wanted to take on journalism, and you kind of are doing the role of a journalist now. I mean, would you still consider going into that, or are you very happy with where you're at now?
Not a snowball's chance in hell. And that is absolutely no dig at journalism at all. It's just, you know, if I think back, if I'd gone into journalism in the beginning when I wanted to, I definitely wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now. And I think I love the independence of what I'm doing now. So, yes, a lot of people have said to me, but really what you are doing is journalism. And maybe it is, in a way. But I think it's my own sort of accumulation of different elements of journalism, perhaps, and storytelling. And I just really do love the independence of it and being able to cover the cases I want to cover.
Yeah, I think it is really important. Even with one of the documentaries I did, I didn't have a boss per se. It was sort of coming from my own drive and my own passion to tell that story. Yeah. And that makes a big difference, right? Because you can kind of follow your gut and say, look, I don't think that's the good way to go. And you have a lot more power over your stories, which I'm not saying journalists don't have, but you do have people sort of pushing you in certain to go and look somewhere or go and do that or get something out today. You know, that's very important for the news cycle.
Yeah.
And then my last question for you would be like, what would you like readers to take away from this book?
I think most importantly, the knowledge of the 10 cases and to pass that on as many times as they can to other people who don't read, you know, at bras, at family dinners, wherever they may be, talk about these victims and their families and their cases because you never really do know. And then also the education side of it, the information that I've shared about what we, how we should be covering or managing missing person cases, and if sadly anyone experiences loss to murder, that certainly as well. And also I just think, you know, perhaps on a broader scale, we've had a lot of bad press about podcasts recently. And as South Africa's in a big rise in the podcast arena at the moment, I'd like the public to take away from this that podcasts can be used for good as well, if they're done properly and ethically and with the right sort of vision in mind.
Yeah, it is. It is sort of the future, isn't it? And it's always going to have its learning curves, and you've got to work all of that out. But I do think, based on what you've achieved and this book and hopefully many more books after this, that there will be more cases that you can cover, and hopefully we can get that lead that could break a case wide open and find justice for the families.
That would be incredible.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, just, it's. I really hope that everyone finds value in the book. It really is accumulation of 6 years of lots of hard work, but also a lot of passion. And I don't think over the last 6 years I've actually felt like I was working a single day, because I'm just so grateful to be able to tell these stories and do this work. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Nicole. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Did you love what you heard? Don't just stop at the stories. Buy the books. Visit your favorite bookstore to grab your next read. And remember to subscribe, share, and join us again next week for more fascinating conversations. Until then, happy reading.